My name is Walter Hartwell White. I live at 308 Negra Arroyo Lane, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87104. This is my confession.
Cavaliers Break Bad. And before we begin, we've been advised by the New South Wales Health Association to warn all our listeners that when watching the latest episode of Breaking Bad, it is important to avoid heart complications, to tread lightly.
Yeah, there we go.
All right, so.
All right.
I'm Sara.
I'm Grippy.
And. The tension.
Yep. The tension.
So,
all the tension.
If you've seen the episode, which, like, you better bloody have seen the episode, because I don't know what the hell you're going to get out of this.
Spoiler territory.
You will know that this was possibly the most amazingly tense episode of Breaking Bad ever.
Yep.
And the distinction of ever is really important, because you kind of say that when you're talking about a show like Breaking Bad, like, oh, that was the best thing ever. Think back to Run, and think back to
a number of just
Face Off. All these iconic moments,
like, yeah,
they feel just like fucking child's play.
Yeah, it's and it sounds like overstatement. Like, usually, it always sounds like overstatement when you're talking about something this awesome. But you know, like when you go to somebody, you say, "Dude, this fucking episode." You say it after every single one, so.
I know,
you know,
but
people
kind of
get
like
into it at some point,
really,
but like with something like this, this is
it escalated different. Tonight. Well, yeah. I remember when I watched it for the first time. You've watched it three
times
yeah. Tonight.
Okay, yeah, okay. This is so what it's now 1:08 AM in Sydney. I watched it first at about 3, then again at about 10 with Saro, then again about midnight. So I've seen it a good 3 times, and I'm yeah, I'm in the zone. And sorry, you've seen it twice.
Yeah, I've seen it twice.
And the thing about that was
back to back. And,
yeah,
and when I watched it the first time, I actually, like, you could see physical effects
yeah,
on my body. It really, I was really left in a bit of a state. And then I had to text my dad to be like, can you please be careful when you watch this? Because I'm worried you may have a heart attack and die.
Yeah, 60, what, 60-something?
Yeah, he, well, he's in his early 60s. And
yeah.
I, you know, everyone's going, ha, you know, what a good way of, like, communicating the intensity. Like, no, that's just an anecdote of how I'm worried about my father's health.
No.
Like, this could kill him, this episode.
Give
he's not particularly unhealthy, but.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. Give us a shout. But, like, that's just watching people respond. I've seen two different sets of people respond to this episode. One's just, I must say, watching Saro respond to both Walt's confession and Jesse's piecing together of the information, just watching both of those was gratifying almost, particularly seeing Jesse piece it together, seeing your face, because you called it.
Oh,
and of course,
I called it, I think, in the first podcast. I hope I did. I know I mentioned that to you.
You definitely called it.
I'm pretty sure I called it in the podcast. But look, we'll get into that. This is all kind of a very random preamble, a pre-ramble, if you will.
Pre-ramble, mate.
Before I start, I do have to be annoying and just say, first of all, like, thanks for listening.
We've had a lot of traffic.
We've escalated, and we got, and just want to read out one email, probably not all of it, because, you know, we try, the review said that we were short, or that we didn't ramble on, and so I don't want to work against that. Anyway, so basically, Alina wrote in, and said, hi guys, one thing I need to take you to task on is that, and similar to every other Breaking Bad podcast I've listened to, you completely misunderstood Walt's cancer diagnosis. Someone diagnosed with lung cancer will die, but there are no exceptions to this rule unless they are killed in a drug war first. Walt cannot be cured of lung cancer. Being in remission simply means that the treatment has succeeded in temporarily stopping the active growth of the tumours. Being in remission simply means that he has more time than he thought he had, because his tumours have responded well to the chemo and radio. The cancer will inevitably come back. Walt is still dying of terminal cancer, he just got a bit more time than he thought he had in the initial episode. There's much more, and I'm sorry I have to cut it there.
But yeah, no, it's
and yeah,
it's a fair criticism.
We fucked up there.
Yeah,
to be fair, I always knew that it was like likely the cancer would come back. Mm. I just never knew that was inevitable. Mm. And I think like you could have made this show. I think the way they've done it is the right way to go. But you could have done this show where Walt's cancer doesn't come into remission until after he dies. As in, it doesn't come into remission.
Yeah.
He's killed before that happens. That I think that would have worked. So I guess. I mean, we were wrong. I'm not trying to backtrack and say we're wrong, but I still think, like, the same basic point, because I think it's a reference to season two, and it's very, very important now, of course, because
the cancer is back.
I think it still stands that the idea that when he gets that, the remission announcement, diagnosis, he's freaked out because he doesn't have a sense of finality. I mean, even if the cancer is inevitably coming back, you have no idea when.
And then, oh yeah, and then following that is one of my favourite moments in the entire series, of course, when he's drifting across the different lanes of traffic.
Mm.
Brilliant. Anyway, we should probably get into confessions, but yeah.
It's apt to that episode. All right, so confessions.
Right, so one point that we will probably be harping on a lot, Michael Slovis directed this episode.
Yeah, he did.
The DP of this brilliant show since, I think, season two? Because it was Reynaldo.
Yeah, it was season
before that.
No, actually, it might even be.
Might be
three.
A bit later. I'll, you know, have a look.
Because we also remember we noticed that three kind of stepped up a bit in terms of the cinematography.
Yeah.
Not necessarily everything else. But yeah, Michael Slovis has directed Live Free or Die, Cornered, and his episodes aren't really the greatest. The episodes he's done so far aren't.
Kafka-esque was. Brilliant. I mean,
it's great. But these aren't the episodes. They're not your half measures. They're not your face-offs. They're not your Phoenixes.
They're not your Bernsteins.
And that's the thing also about when we talk about directors, you kind of have to look for it because the directors that get the chunkiest plot episodes aren't necessarily the best directors.
Yeah.
And that's my argument with
McLaren.
Yeah, I just briefly forgot a name. Sorry, Michelle.
I'm sure she'll be so.
I know,
such a personal affront.
Yeah, and I think Michelle McLaren, she will always do amazing things with what she has. Mm. Like last week. However, Michael Slovis hit the fucking jackpot with this one.
He really, really hit it out of the park. Like I have so many things to say about this episode.
Yeah,
so I suppose we kind of just have to go through them one by one.
I know, and we'll just kind of
crap on about Slovis when we get to them.
I think there's two main moments, obviously, that we want to discuss about in terms of the directing and like, the elements of film,
yeah,
basically.
I'm guessing, obviously, Walt's confession.
Yes.
When Hank and Marie watched that and...
the final moments, really.
As in when Jesse goes into the house. No, for me, they're just.
We'll talk about it as we go.
So,
But yes.
So yeah, this cold open.
All right, this cold open, very subtle, very understated. Doesn't have the oomph effect of a lot of Breaking Bad cold opens, but I thought it was actually really strong and good.
Mm. And particularly in the understated brilliance of it, I kind of think of it. As we've kind of been talking about with Blood Money and Buried, there has been this really good habit of kind of bookending episodes so far. But the thing is, with this one, I mean, it's not even really that explicit, but the opening frame is Todd lighting a cigarette.
Yeah.
And then coming to it,
basically we get the
reveal of Jesse realizing about Huell and Saul and Walt and the rice and cigarette, and watching it a second time, kind of thinking about that was just like, there's this, in script writing, there's this pledge. There's the thing that you say that the first image almost makes a promise to an audience that this is kind of what we're going to address. And it was in my mind the first time, because I'm like, that's still one of the questions.
What
about the cigarette? When's Jesse going to find out about the cigarette?
Yeah, that's true. He starts with a cigarette. And also, I just think the way this scene, because it takes up the cold open, and that's all we see of them for this episode. And like Jesse last episode, although he appeared at the end again, very smart that they didn't shove them back in there.
Mm.
First of all, we've been talking about Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead a lot lately.
I swear to God, not just because
it's currently playing in Sydney. Like, it's just, I don't know, it's very kind of archetypal characters. But I think we're really onto something. I think this is a theme of the season because Todd's description of the dead freight, of the train heist, is so interesting and important. So first of all, with these guys talking about the train heist, and then Huell and Kuby last week. The myth of Heisenberg is really building, you understand, and it's pushing us closer to how his name is now, like, graffiti on the wall.
Yeah.
And of course, Todd, you know, talks about it, like, and then he planned everything out, and we managed to get it just the way he said. And of course, when you hear this all secondhand, you think, well, this Heisenberg guy, fuck, you know, he's on another level. He's German sounding, so, you know...
And he's got connects in the Czech Republic.
And that's the thing. It's just great. It's just like on top of everything that goes down in this episode. It's just kind of, we got some Nazis coming.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. Just the reason Todd's calling him in the first place is I know you're busy with retirement and all, but like, don't mean to interrupt, but there's been a change of management, so yeah, whatever, if you want to call back. He's just so, like, he's very Todd about it.
Yeah,
and you kind of see, like, the way he kind of casually mentions that he's got, like, an uncle in prison.
He's very Jesse Plemons, yeah.
I love Jesse Plemons. Jesse Plemons is absolutely fucking
great. You're not allowed to say you love Jesse Plemons until you've seen Friday Night Lights.
He's just talking shit in a diner, like... He's killed Drew Sharp.
Well, this is the really essential thing.
One
of the main things about that whole, what Todd says in this episode is they say, and nothing went wrong. No, nothing went wrong. He doesn't mention the kid.
Mm.
He doesn't mention Drew Sharp. Like, it's not even that, that's the thing that's so terrifying about Todd is like, in no way is he sadistic or like, it is all a good time for him. So Drew Sharp is not...
even a footnote. Doesn't even register.
I know. So that's, you know, that's true kind of sociopathy.
And of course, like, while it mightn't show up in Todd's mind anywhere, when Jesse's waiting to...
Well, we'll get there.
But,
that's also appalling that we missed that the first time.
Well, second time as well. But it's lovely. I just think, you know, it's kind of like a little, even another hubristic little thing for Todd is that he just fucking shoots his mouth off. Like, he kind of doesn't realize he's threatening people. He's kind of just
He's the young guy in this kind of old time. Isn't it's like, well, here's my cool story.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Here's what I did this summer.
And like, he reckons he's so cool. But the one thing about this, like, as much as I love the presence of Todd,
I had a problem.
As much as I love the presence of Todd, this cold open, if it's about anything, it's not about Todd. It's about his uncle and the other dude and the presence of them. And the thing is, so many times Breaking Bad will kind of like really kind of make it obvious to you in its understatement that something is really tense. This isn't necessarily obvious. He wipes some blood off his shoe, but we know exactly where that's come from.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, where'd that blood come from? This guy's crazy. It's, this guy's crazy. We knew that. Now he's wiping blood off his shoe just a little bit. But it's almost waiting for something to happen in there that's like, you're not sure what you're supposed to be tense about.
Exactly. And the thing is, it kind of serves the same purpose, although done in a much more understated way, as the cousin cold opens season three when... But because Breaking Bad has become so full-on and just so dense lately, it just feels like almost this kind of... gloating to the audience of, so you're about to see some pretty fucked up shit. We're going to return you to our regular programming. Just before we do that, I just want to remind everyone that we have some Nazis in the mix that will come back into this later and obviously are going to fuck shit up. However, just one problem I have with that scene. So the final shot is they have now entering New Mexico,
bringing the methylamine back.
I don't know. It just kind of was like, they weren't in New Mexico.
They're in Arizona, yeah.
Yeah, and then it's like, they're coming to New Mexico. Okay, I don't know, that just felt like it was given more than it really deserved in terms of emphasis.
Nah.
Alright, yeah, fair enough, I guess.
I think, like, you know, to mark it, like, it's marking it enough that, like, Todd's kind of calling Walt.
Mm.
He's kind of, like, making him aware of their business, and he, in partnership with Lydia, which I'd also like to touch on, in partnership with Lydia, are going to make Walt a part of this scene, however reluctantly he will be there. But the thing is, for me... is we've kind of got some kind of awareness of the Todd-Lydia relationship, but the thing is, watching Todd's uncle in this, it calls into question Lydia's presence for me. Because he's hardly a Mike to Lydia's Gus,
But once again, as I said last week, everyone who underestimates Lydia dies, and I think that's exactly... And the only person who seems to respect and live to serve Lydia is Todd. So I think we're going to get this very much, very classic scenario where she's the big bad, and, you know, Fuck, I keep calling him Jesse, which really means that they're doing their job at kind of subtly paralleling the two, not particularly subtly.
Yeah.
But with Todd kind of as her dragon. But we should move on and go to after credits. All right, now, first of all, what a fucking good but also just downright, so ridiculous bait and switch.
Wait, which one? The with the
Jesse? Just generally this first scene. So the episode's called Confessions, and like we end with, and we know some serious shit's going to go down, and it doesn't disappoint. Some serious shit just go down, but the whole Hank Jesse interrogation is so anticlimactic.
Oh yeah, and no, that's the thing. Like he leave. We're left at the end of last week's episode, kind of just going, the door's slammed, something's going to go down, and that's the thing. So much of the time with the cliffhangers, there. It's not that they don't live up to expectations, it's just that you get redirected so often.
Mm.
And that's the thing with this, like...
I can see why they did a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Whereas last week I was like, oh, come on.
But the thing is, also, naming it Confessions kind of naturally kind of positions you to think maybe it's going to come from Jesse.
Naming it Confessions, it doesn't even make you think maybe it's going to come to Jesse. You end in that shot last week and it's like, oh, next week's called Confessions. Oh, my God. The first scene, they're going to be teaming up.
Oh, it's
going
to be a 10-minute...
and it's not. And, of course, it can't be because, like, Jesse at this stage, he doesn't know about Brock, and he still really hates Hank, he hates the DEA, he also has no purpose, like, he hates Walt, but
he's still in his catatonic state.
At this stage, he's still in his catatonic state, so I think from a character and plot standpoint, this made a hell of a lot more sense, but, like, the first time you watch it, you're like, what? But it wasn't ultimately anticlimactic, because I just knew these are the final 8 episodes and there's going to be a climax of sorts in every single episode.
Well, see,
and there are a few in this one.
I just, you know, you get to a point where you know Breaking Bad too well to go, like, it's going to be clear cut. When Hank walks out of that room where he and Jesse are in relation, like, no. But the thing was, again, just for Slovis on this, so far, we've kind of had, at the beginning of every episode after the cold open, immediately taking up where the action was left off last week. And technically this week we don't, because we've got, like, slow-mo on Jesse while we've got a time-lapse.
Yeah.
And this is a
Breaking Bad
loves time-lapse. Slovis loves time-lapses, but they're always of places and never really humans.
Yeah, actually, speaking of Breaking Bad techniques, there's one I forgot to note.
There's one, I just think, you know, you've got, what are they called? Tall and taller is what Saul calls them when he comes in. But you just got the slow-mo kind of paralleled with the time-lapse on the two police officers in the space. So technically it is kind of, you know, your standard time-lapse. But at the same time, it's completely not, because it's about, you know, a subjective experience of that kind of, like, relation to time, which is really nice, and, again, just, you know, I love it when cinematographers direct.
I mean, this was such a director's episode, because in terms of...
Cinematographer's director's episode, you know.
Just in terms of the way that they're kind of representing, it wasn't a realist piece, wasn't a naturalist piece in the sense that they kind of went crazy in representing what was going on through the way they framed it and edited it, and particularly, obviously Slovis is doing... I didn't actually check. I assume Kelly Dixon edited this one, but the editing also was a massive part of this episode.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that scene with Hank and Jesse, as we said, is it's such a bad climax. But Hank, once again, overplays his hand, as he did with Skylar. And and he's telling everyone involved in this and not telling the DEA. And I get his reasoning. Like, it all makes... I can see how it all makes sense to him, but... Oh, it's not good, Hank.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's something you just see him, as we were kind of talking about last week, he's just now too obsessed, and he can't really... He can't see the woods for the trees.
Yes.
As I said last week. But I really, really... just a couple of moments, just... I love that Hank's reveal of, like, I know that my brother-in-law is Heisenberg. That's just on Jesse. It's just so economically covered.
Yeah, it's just kind of like, I'm not working up for anything. Well, that's pretty fucking intense. Yeah.
And just, like, staying on, like, the pace of this scene is more dictated by Jesse in his catatonia rather than just, like, with a lot of these dialogue scenes, we've kind of seen, like, a lot of coverage and a lot of cutting, but this one kind of takes a different pace, which I really appreciate, particularly when Saul comes in. Normally with Saul, you kind of got this really rapid kind of shit going everywhere, but even then, kind of got camera moving with him to move the other camera, coming back with him. You've kind of got that covered in two shots, which is just really nice and kind of, I think, again, with the subjective kind of experience of Jesse. So, you know, really kind of positioned to be a part of that. And this episode is so, so much a Jesse episode. I mean, yeah. That's the thing. Like, you almost don't really think about it because, you know, like...
It is. And it's also just the moment where he snapped because, I mean, he was barely in last episode. So yeah. You're kind of going, they're really not using Aaron Paul that much.
Yeah. But... And I was kind of curious about, like, why he was underplaying everything so much. But then, of course...
it makes sense.
Then
and
you're
also...
like, yep.
I mean, it's very, very clever, you know, because Aaron Paul is so beloved and that character is so loved that, you know... It's
everyone's going to notice.
It's just kind of like, you know, another show would just be like, how do we get Jesse into the first two? And they went, we've got some stuff, don't worry. Mm-hmm. Don't you worry, yeah. Folks. Anyway, so let's go back to Walt putting on his makeup. God, that's funny. And then... the first confession of the episode.
Wait, before that, we see Walt getting a call from Saul, and I'd just like to touch on this. There's three moments in this episode where we see one half of telephone calls, and in just most stuff, not just Breaking Bad, in most television film, you're going to see two sides of a phone call.
And with this, more so in TV as well.
More so in TV, particularly because they love to intercut. Yeah, exactly. Bless you. But so you've got Walt... talking to Saul after he's seen Jesse. Then you've got kind of like Walt shouting out to Walter Jr. from the bathroom, which is, I mean, less of a clear-cut example, but still one that kind of complements the argument. And then at the end, after Jesse's kind of given Saul a scene too, Saul ringing Walt at the end to tell him that Jesse's now gone, like, tits
yeah,
up.
Yeah, that's true.
And this is that's the thing. And then you see Walt. You don't see him hear the news. You just see him
react.
Like,
yeah.
We just or not react rather with Skyler in the car wash. But that's the thing. I think that's something. I don't know. I don't know really who to kind of thank for that kind of attitude. But I feel
that would be a script thing.
Yeah,
they have
I know.
Script,
but
so
like,
it'd be the writers.
I feel like it really kind of complements the way Slovis directs in a lot of ways. Just his attitude, like. Unlike a lot of directors can really like to focus in on like face and character, but a cinematographer really respects space.
Yeah.
And I think particularly with this episode where you really kind of got everyone kind of almost wishing that they could run and kind of like, which has kind of been the case for most of Breaking Bad, kind of wishing that they could like up and leave and kind of just escape. Like they're in kind of this space where they're not, it's not claustrophobic, but they can't really move.
Well, they're isolated from each other, and I think that's just the whole thing of this season is, you know, Jesse's against Walt, and Walt and Skyler against Hank and Marie, and the Sauls.
Yeah.
So I think it...
Not even that, just in the sense of, like, kind of, like, playing on the desert, like, the Albuquerque kind of desert, as a kind of metaphor, like, this broad open space in which they can still manage to feel claustrophobic, and I feel like Slovis' cinematography does that in a lot of ways.
It also goes back to the Cirque thing from last week.
Well, yeah, sure. But, like, also just, like, staying in one space, like, when most telephone conversations will kind of cut across a number of them and kind of give you some kind of displaced kind of feeling. Like, this really kind of just sits in it. And I just... That's some one thing I really noticed about this episode, which I really loved.
Yeah.
And you can pick it up with all of
Sure, sure.
Stuff.
I do think, though, that the... Yeah, but also... We've never seen people more disconnected in Breaking Bad. Like, there's no Walt and Jesse.
They're stuck in their own worlds.
Walt and Saul anymore because, like, Walt is so clearly Saul's boss. I mean, so all the dynamics have changed of the relationships.
Yeah.
You know, Hank and Marie and Walt and Skyler will never be playing bridge again or whatever.
Yeah,
they play. So there's that. But anyway,
so basically, Slovis.
So the first monologue.
Point. Yeah, cool. Which
the first confession I meant to say, where. Walt. Oh, Walt. Jesus Christ.
With Walt Jr. Oh,
with Walt Jr., it was just the most pathetic...
Evil genius, Heisenberg.
I know. But the line that is so important here is when he's talking about the cancer to Jr. and he's trying to play it down as much as possible, and he says... I beat this once, there's no reason to think I won't beat it again. That sums up, I think, everything about this season. It's everything that we've spent the whole show getting out of, there's no escape from this time. The lies to Jesse don't work anymore. Mm. Hank knows. And the cancer, which once was an is now definitely coming to kill him.
Yeah.
Although, as I said...
It always was.
We should
but
go
now,
back to our,
but yeah,
our correction.
Now it is
it's
very,
it's
very
on.
Real
so
presence.
Everything... So Walt, you know, it speaks to Walt's character, I think, that, you know, he's still going on about this idea that, you know, because he's done it once, he can do it again. And so much of this episode is, you know, don't Hank calls him out on his shit of, you know, just trying to wriggle out of it with his, you know, fancy speeches. Jesse's talking about how he's being played by Walt. So this whole idea of what worked before isn't going to work this time. Yeah. And that goes for the whole season. I think it's just kind of like there's no more of that kind of, as much as we love getting out of problems, it's just all about creating them and escalating them this season.
Yeah, and you just see, but just in this moment, like you kind of see him playing the evil genius and completely getting Walt Jr. hook, line and sinker, almost in a way that he hasn't been able to for this season, just because at least this half of, like, where everything's kind of starting to unravel and he's trying to clumsily kind of get everything together. This is kind of one moment where he's like, I've got this. And yeah, you see the you see the arrogance with which he deals with it. And at the end, he's even like, now you go to your Aunt Marie's, knowing that he's going to say, no, I'm staying here.
I know.
And then he has the look on his face, that fucking arrogant, like, well, I am Heisenberg. The satisfaction when he's got him hook, line, and sinker. And you're just like, the karma's building up, bro.
I know. Like, but also the thing is that it's not, I think, like, he could always have had, well, hook, line, and sinker, but except for, he's only ever shown interest in Walt Jr. really two times. The first was during the divorce, where Walt Jr. was like a power play against Skylar, and now again, when Walt Jr. matters something in his, you know, battle against Hank and Marie. So he's just using Walt Jr. essentially, and he's only kind of interested in him when he's involved in kind of these power struggles he's having with people. Mm. So yeah, which is kind of fucked. I mean, that whole, there's like, if we want to just revive this podcast when we get depressed, there's no more Breaking Bad. There's probably like one to do just on like Walter White as father and how weird it all is. Cause it goes beyond just the obvious stuff.
Yeah.
But let's just jump to, I think, the Mexican restaurant.
No. There's one scene, of course, just before where it's where they set up the confession. Yeah. But like, it's just a really nice moment and kind of almost sets up for the way the confession is filmed, with Hank and Marie. It's just
camera
kind of jumps from Walt to behind the camera and seeing the viewfinder on the little camera. It's just a really nice moment. I think it's kind of a cinematographer's moment, really.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing. Medium Cool by Haskell Wexler is at the moment, definitely one of my favorite films, and I've just fucking loved it, seen it recently. You need to watch that, by the way. But it's just really cinematographer turned director. They have a certain love for the camera, which I share. And any time a cinematographer kind of looks at a camera, you feel the love. I feel the love. And, you know, so that's something. So moving, we will really get to that.
Yeah.
So let's move to the Mexican restaurant and Trent. And
yeah. All right. So, Trent, the waiter at, and the thing is like, I was reading some stuff and some people were suggesting this was perhaps too broad or like too obvious. I'm like, no, it's so distinctly Breaking Bad that when you have your big combustible scene, you'd have some fucking overbearing smarmy waiter who's trying to sell you the guacamole that they make on the table. Would like to say, if this was a 13 episode order, if they had the time, that guacamole would be made and we would sit through the entire awkward ordeal.
It'd be like the shawarma episode in the shawarma bit in Avengers.
Yes, the dark inverse of the shawarma moment. I kind of wish I'd seen that. But anyway, first of all, like, what's so noticeable is Skylar's wearing beige and Hank's wearing purple. Like,
which just is further accentuated later in
like,
the house.
It's like, you know, it's like couples dance-off night, you know? Like, these I don't know how to put it. Just like these two old married couples. Like, they're not that old, obviously, but you know, playing off each other. Like, it's so, because we've had the dynamic where it's Marie and Skylar and Hank and Walt, or, you know, and that's usually what they play off of more. But to really see the Whites and the Schraders so against each other, which we've seen separately with Hank and Walt and then Marie and Skylar before, but we finally get the couples consolidating their kind of goals together and then coming at each other, now dressed officially in team colours. Like, it's literally team white and team purple.
Yeah.
It was brilliant.
Well, team beige and team, yeah.
Well, team beige, and, but you could
but
go
yeah,
team
pretty
white
much. You'd be forgiven for stretching
and it's cuter. And, you know, and also, like, Walt's wearing a grey jumper, a very kind of feminine grey jumper, which has some scarlet. Like, the costumes in this scene, Jesus, they were good. I think that this whole scene, it kind of just felt like a sort of a catch-up on what we developed last episode with the kind of how the family dynamic operates now. But more, the main thing that I really took away from this scene was when, you know, they're arguing, and then Hank turns to Skyler and goes, don't think you're I'm not coming after you if you keep on this silly, this bullshit with Walt. Hank is so outraged that Skyler would take Walt's side, particularly after she really fucked him over last episode.
Yeah.
And also I love the moral outrage of Walt with Walt Jr., where they're talking about it. And he says, he just found out his father had cancer. You want to put suicide to put this on top of that? And the moral outrage in his voice.
And then you've got Hank kind of saying, don't talk to me about right. Is it right to run a drug empire? And the funny thing is, like, as we were kind of talking about earlier, I think finally, kind of Hank, like, diegetically, the question's being asked. Yes. The people in discussing the show have been asking for such a long time.
He's such an audience surrogate at this point. He's just saying, like, Walt will say something, and we're like, oh, Walt, you're bullshit. And then Hank will just say,
cut it down,
you're bullshit. Yeah. So, like, for the first time in the show's history, and at the most necessary point, because Walt is so unlikable at this point, we have someone actually in the show going, he's a monster, he's a terrible, terrible person. Also, I love that when they begin, Hank says to Walt, so you're here to confess. Once again, this title just gets so much use, even though there are no confessions in this particular scene. And then we get a DVD, and this scene... All right, before we jump into the kind of deconstructing it cinematically, just on a plot level, like... It makes sense, but fuck the balls on Walt and the writers. I was just sitting there going, I can't believe this is happening.
Yeah.
You know, just everything, the details, the Hector Salamanca.
And you're just like, he's not going to pull that.
And I love how it's kind of like it becomes he sold him to Gus Fring. So the family threatening. No, that was Gus. I still, like, he gets to kind of merge it, so he's still at odds with Gus, but then eventually all the actually illegal stuff comes back to Hank.
Yeah.
It's unbelievably. Yeah.
And also, Walt, not Bryan Cranston, Walt is an incredible actor.
Love that he's a showy actor. Walt, he's a good actor, but he's a showy actor. And you see this particularly with his lies in Skyler, and because she knows him best, she knows when she's lying. He has to do the lie, and you can see him working and enjoying play. And we'll come to this in the end, but you get it much more in season 3 when there's less openness. But he didn't have to cry. But he's just he's almost like that really egotistical actor who's going, I can cry for you. I can elevate this scene. And it's just so... It's really hard to do acting that is clearly acting to the audience, but not bad acting. Wait, hang on.
What, Inception?
Well, all right, there's good bad acting, which is when actors act badly, when characters act badly.
Yeah.
And that's very funny and sort of, And then there's, like, acting, it's just these several layers of lies, where it's kind of like Bryan Cranston is playing Walt as a good liar, but to the extent where the audience can very much pick up on the difference between his truth and his lies, while still within the world of the show, it's still completely believable. And I think that's possibly the hardest thing you can do as an actor and the most impressive. And that's like Bryan Cranston's particular skill. And he's amazing at it and really comes to show here.
And, I mean, Walt wouldn't be the character he is without that aspect. So the thing is with this, though, is that when you're seeing that, you're almost... And the way... And this scene, we kind of mentioned it before, the way it is shot has so much to do with the way you kind of interpret it. First off, the way the camera is always moving.
Apart
from
I really just want to read my raw uncut notes. So this is what I'm writing as it comes to my head. The slight pan with the camera. Next point. The framing. all caps. Oh, the directing, the cutting. How many takes did they do? like the bump in on the scar. Like just
oh, Christ.
The. All right, so let's like talk about the individual shots because I've memorized them all. There is one that I think I really like, which is it's quite a wide shot and it's Hank, Marie, arms to the side,
watching this
back
TV.
To the audience with the TV in between them, and it's a very like it once again has that kind of melodrama aspect of characters that are kind of dwarfed by their space and trapped by it, which I really love. So you get that, and occasionally cut back to that. You get a pan around the two of them, right? So you get a very, very slight slow pan around the two of them that keeps the camera movement and keeps this intensity. Then what's interesting, you have a pan around Hank.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have a pan around Marie on...
Just circling them.
No, so, but in the opposite direction, so they each get their own... camera pan around them.
Yeah.
And it, well, no, it's not, yeah. It's
kind
not.
Of turns their heads towards, like, it's really good for moments where they turn towards each other because you've got the movement going with that.
But do they even turn around each
they
other?
They do. Oh. Well, on the $177,000.
Which we'll get to.
Yeah. But
so, then there's so many others, like, there's so many different levels of depth they do to the TV. Like, when he mentioned it in Scar, I said it, you know, they go. They go close up, like extreme. They...
On the screen, not on Walt. On the mid shot on Walt on the screen, you get just his eye or something.
Yeah.
And so you see like the individual pixels. You see the low quality of.
You see the red light in the television.
Yeah, exactly. So you get all just... these. It's so. See, for me, when I'm seeing that, and I know that I kind of mentioned this to you, but like I think the first shot is very Haneke. Like if you're to position if Haneke was framing this scene, it
Stop. Oh, people don't know us. Explain who Michael Haneke is.
They don't need to know us to know who Michael Haneke is.
I know.
But sure, okay, Michael.
He's not that well known.
Okay,
all right, Michael Haneke, you'll probably best know as he won the most recent foreign language
Oscar, foreign language Oscar for Amour. He also won won the Palme d'Or for it, and also the Palme d'Or for White Ribbon. Also did Cachet or Hidden, which is one of the better films
and Funny Games.
Of this.
Yeah,
of
look,
this.
He's one of our favourite directors
also,
working currently.
And this particularly, I think maybe my favourite of his Benny's video. This sequence, like of any of his films, very kind of. Almost reminiscent of Benny's video and the way that they shot the screen. And the thing for me is, like, you almost see, in kind of inverse from Benny's video kind of makes you see the audience, which is you, kind of makes you very conscious and scared of the fact that you are watching this. This kind of makes you conscious of a different kind of audience. The when you're watching it, the way I was kind of receiving it was thinking this... Again, thinking as you do with a lot of the shit that happens in Breaking Bad, you're thinking national news, and you're seeing how a video like that could possibly look on a CNN news broadcast in that kind of low quality image that kind of gets blown
the
up.
The found
or whatever.
Footage style, yeah.
And see that for me, like you're thinking ultimately the implications of what this could mean. This confession, should anything happen to Walt, and essentially the threat that it is nothing more than a threat. Mm. Is that were that to be leaked, then that would go absolutely haywire.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that was kind of like a little... It was a different... It was Haneke in that was make you really looking at an image, but not thinking about the image so much as the audience. And you have the immediate audience, which is Hank and Marie, but you're thinking about something a lot bigger. So that was why it was reminiscent of that to me.
Okay, look, well, here's why I think... when that scene started, I thought Haneke, because Haneke loves... Well, first of all, two of his films very much concerned with people watching watching videos.
Mm,
and in fact, Hank and Marie watching Walt's confession is narrative-wise so similar to George and Anna in Hidden, watching the videos. But anyway, look, we won't go on too much about Michael Haneke, but he would have done this shot... In one take, as I said.
It would have been a static long take.
Would have been a static, because that's the thing. Haneke loves to force you to watch things uncomfortably, and he loves... And
it would make no sense thematically. It's achieving
a similar-ish effect, is that he would want to force you, like, through this uncomfortable experience by holding long take. And Slovis does the exact opposite approach, and kind of using the editing and the... But we really should have counted how many shots are in this, like how many
how many edits.
Yeah, no, sorry, not how many edits, how many takes they're using. like how, because they, obviously they're using some of the same takes within the edit. So we really should have counted that up, and we would have if we would. Well, you watched it three times. I don't know what your fucking excuse is. So he would have, but if you're going to go to the route of editing back and forth, which is a more TV thing, like, you need to make it something interesting and something that people in podcasts want to discuss. You need to go all the way, and that is edit the shit out of it, shoot on a stupid amount of angles. Because, I mean, like, if you're a television producer, you've got to go, why do we need to do this scene 50 fucking times from every conceivable angle and from, like, various vantage points? Like, it makes no fucking sense. But Slovis, you know, obviously this is just one of the most shocking, horrifying, nauseating experiences for Hank and Marie. It's the kind of reaction that it invokes is, what are all the various scenarios that can play out here? Mm. Their minds are going to go into damage control. It's going to jump back forth from focus on the video to focus of how do we react to this?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it completely depicts that mindset just by going around their reaction and then back to the TV, then back to them in the space, back to them. It's just so visceral in the way it's constructed.
Mm. And in terms of the way that it's covered, it kind of like almost reminiscent of kind of Crawl Space, just... I think just that, the intensity of that end, you're just like, there's no like music or anything. Like, the only thing you can really hear is Walt's confession, inverted commas. And it's pretty, it's just fucking intense and terrifying. Cause you, I mean, obviously, yeah, you are kind of thinking about, oh shit, the power's kind of been going away from Hank up till now. Who's like, he's kind of had the power knowing that Walt is Heisenberg, and now he's just knows like, he's what done. The fuck are you going to do? Like, where do you go, man?
It's another confession. And it's just a nice touch because, I mean, Marie, what she's done here is something that's kind of a microcosm, like just a small, tiny kind of percent of Skylar's own wrongdoing. You know, it's just like, I wanted to help you. I thought it was just gambling. I didn't realize it would be such a problem. And I completely sympathize with Marie, but she's done what everyone else in this fucking show does and just not really considered the consequences of her actions. And it's come back to destroy them. It's just Hank was on such shaky ground to begin with. And he's fucked. I still think, though, he should tell the fucking DEA.
And this is a... Yeah.
If I was there, I'd be like, listen to your wife. I know she's a crazy purple woman who tries to abduct babies, but listen to your wife.
We might as well mention it now because, like, there's only one real point to mention on it. And I know it is the scene after Walt, Jesse, and Saul in the desert. But when Gomi comes into Hank's office just after this, he kind of, like, says, are you going to tell me why you've got my guys trailing Jesse Pinkman? You know that he'll get us, like, for some lawsuit or whatever. He comes in wearing a purple shirt.
I know, that's exactly.
And it's a really nice little, like, he's, like,
the hilarious thing
putting himself
Marie's,
up as a potential ally.
Marie's purple is always really deep purple and sometimes kind of magenta, whereas he's wearing a light purple shirt. Is that, like, what does that mean? Why am I thinking about this? This is the fucked up shit Breaking Bad does to me.
That's the thing.
And my note, my note is, Gomi's wearing purple, dot, dot, dot. Light purple?
I think he's just kind of like, it's just he's kind of trying to get Hank to just kind of tell him, like, not necessarily anything big, but he at that moment, Hank has the option of kind of telling him about the whole situation. Anyway. And I reckon just, you know, just with that little kind of detail, like, it's like, a potential Schrader ally there, you know, like... You let an opportunity go begging, hanky boy. So.
But having covered most of the 50% that is reserved for the white purple conflict, the white purple wars. That's why it's a light purple shirt, because when you mix white and
that's for you know, that's for the finale.
Yeah, there is, like, also it was all this Gomi. Whole fan theory Gomi. About Gomi being a mole. I'm just like, no, wrong fucking show, they would not do that.
Some people are retarded.
If he does turn up, we're going to have egg on our face.
No,
but he
no,
won't. I know,
no,
I know. I completely get where you're coming from. Or the other great conspiracy theory, grey matter and magical are linked. Ridiculous, but it would be pretty awesome. Anyway, So let's go to... Well, actually, when
that
you...
That sounds like exactly the kind of thing that an extremely tightly plotted show would do. Yep.
Yeah, no.
No, the entire show was a MacGuffin, guys. Yep, there
yeah,
you
no,
go.
It's... No. Yes, they don't...
Fuck you, people who think that.
It also... Yeah, Breaking Bad often is kind of... I feel like it's often sort of like... within conventional narrative structure, you know, a lot of great television, so-called great television, and indeed great television, like Sopranos, and its kind, you know, askew conventions and sort of like, well, you know, the ending you would have wanted would have been predictable and boring, and Breaking Bad is in this constant state of going, we'll give you what you want, and you won't see it coming, because we're fucking geniuses.
Well, what Aaron Paul, he posted on Twitter... earlier today, you will poop your pants tonight and you will be happy about it.
Yeah, like, that's pretty much it. I mean, I just kind of had convulsions. Yeah. But anyway, so, like, Walt and Jesse move in the desert and...
Just quickly, another... At the end of, like, the scene, you've got Hank saying, Jesus Christ, Marie, and I kind of saw a funny little post online somewhere a couple of weeks ago or a couple of days ago saying, you know, the Keanu face, like, what if Marie's real name is Jesus Christ Marie Schrader?
I love that, yeah. That's so good. Yeah, no, that's kind of, like, up there with the purple and Walt Jr.'s breakfast. Yeah. Jesus Christ Marie. and also that he draws it out in this episode. It's Jesus Christ Marie.
Hank, do you take Jesus Christ Marie?
Anyway, so... Meeting in the desert. First thing we see in the desert is
the tarantula.
You watched it twice, and we didn't notice it until the end. I'm like,
didn't notice it.
One, like, that's the kind of shot that's like,
true shot.
Well, we'll put this in for those weird guys that do podcasts about Breaking Bad.
No, I don't think it. I think that's the first watch.
Exactly, it's even more obvious, but it's the kind of like very small shit that really it is like our base requirement to notice immediately. Like, that's the kind of eyes, and I just can't believe it took us till second watch to see that because it's so in your face. The spider in the desert and just reminding you of the sins of Heisenberg's past as Jesse is about to confront him.
Well, just from Jesse's point of view and just like kind of reminding him and as a result of that, reminding us. So, yeah, that fucking tarantula, I can't believe I missed it. Oh my God.
I know, pathetic. Yeah. Anyway, so then Walt gives his... Well, this whole scene hinges on a lack of confession. Because every scene... And actually, that's also a good seven minutes long scene as well. Yeah, that's true minutes. Also of the Hank Gomi scene. It's like, tell me, and I'm like, I'm not going to tell you. Yeah. So pretty much every scene in this episode is based around, except for the cold open, is based around a confession of sorts.
Or the lack thereof.
It's based on the kind of the setup of the confession, you know. Someone telling someone, like admitting to something.
Yeah.
True or false, and whether or not they do it or not.
Yeah.
Is irrelevant. So, but what's so horrific about this little speech that Walt gives to Jesse is there's still a touch of truth. Like, the thing is, whenever I say, like, Walt actually does still care about Jesse,
they're
like, no, but he's awful. It's like, no, that's the thing. Awful people don't not care about other people. Like, the measure of selfishness is sociopath, but I still yeah that's true but that's the thing Walt's not a sociopath he's possibly a psychopath but
I'd say even though psychopath? All his,
yeah, oh, yeah maybe well look the thing about Walt is though is that he does care about what other people think of him and that can like come out in I guess like a very warped version of what we humans call affection. So his whole feelings towards Jesse, it's kind of like, yes, look, when it's between you and me, I will always choose me, but I still want you to look up to me as the divine drug dealer / father figure / science teacher. And when he's talking about this, he sounds so much like a teacher. He uses the phrase, you're still so damn young. I mean, it sounds like he's talking to a high school guidance counselor.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's talking about this trip, you know, could be good for you, could be great opportunities. It's kind of like, look, here are some brochures for colleges that are within your grade point average range.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this one right here could really, really be great for you, Mr. Pinkman. It's just like, it's unbelievably forced
teacher
and
mode.
Just...
Teacher mode.
He's in full teacher mode. He also says, I'd trade places. Like, and not even like, you know, Jesse, it's really hard, I'd trade places. It's just kind of a, huh. I trade places, son.
And you're just watching it the whole time, just going, oh.
Oh, it's so... And then
Jesse
when Jesse calls
finally
him out,
calls
yeah.
him on his bullshit.
And he's barely keeping it together. And then Walt... And the thing is Walt genuinely clueless about how, like, clearly Jesse sees him? Because part of me feels like, yes, he knows he's a bad person, and, like, he can't be as kind of a good liar as he is without having some sense of self-awareness, but I still think he thinks that, like, the relationship he's had with Jesse at the best of times is still a salvageable thing that is earned. Mm-hmm. Like, that he is genuinely shocked by Walt calling him out, by Jesse calling him out.
Yeah.
And then he gives him that hug.
The rape hug.
It is. It's a non-consensual hug. Oh. And Jesse just goes limp.
He just... Oh.
And has this face of utter invasion and helplessness. Not helplessness, just revulsion.
Yeah. And the weird thing is, when you see Walt, you see in a way that... He does mean it in a weird way.
In a weird way. And this is my whole thing about the last thing Walt will do will protect Jesse.
Yeah, and I'd still like to see that, and I'm not ruling that out at all. And I kind of just finally, you know, I kind of figured I should start reading up on stuff. Like, a lot of people just see him purely, like, as in Walt sees Jesse purely as yet another puzzle piece to be manipulated. And for a lot of the time, yes, that is absolutely the
Walt
case.
Walt sees everything that way, but he still has this kind of...
There is still that Walt-Jesse relationship, which I really kind of hope to see. Not because I want to see redemption for Walt, because I don't think he can achieve it, but I just think it would make sense. With the entire character dynamic that they've established so long.
The point at the end isn't so much, like, that's the thing. He doesn't get redemption, but he does something.
Yeah.
Because at this point,
not because
he's tipped the scale so far, he can't really do anything to make up for it. But, like, faced with, not like, doing nothing or saving Jesse, you know, at the end of the day, there's something. But anyway, it's going to be...
I just think it might be the kind of thing where he's kind of told himself the whole time that he's done everything for his family. If they all die, say, before Ozymandias, maybe in Ozymandias.
Yeah, well, as I said, the main climax, I think, is going to happen. Although we don't know now, because the house fucking burned this episode.
Yeah.
We assume.
Yeah, well, yeah. But I think it could be a nice little diversion if, like, he just kind of got bored with the gasoline and then left. Be a nice little Breaking Bad diversion.
Yeah, well, I mean, they didn't show the burn, so you're kind of like, I guess that just is delayed gratification. Mm. Also, maybe because they don't want to, like, spend money on a fucking fire.
Or it could be a really fucking cool opening shot after the cold open.
Yes, or it could be a cruel piece of misdirection.
Yeah, no. I just also like to point out this scene with those three. Just a couple of things.
Well, first of all, I just would like to point out, I love what Bob Odenkirk is doing in the background. Like, it's so awkward, but it's very good.
And the thing is, I'd like to touch on that, because I kind of feel that, like, Jesse's paranoia in this scene, like, he's saying, you're going to kill me like you killed Mike. And I think as I was saying earlier, like, with the kind of subjective experience of a lot of this episode, at least all the stuff with Jesse... You experience it
with everyone, pretty much.
I think in this scene, you're almost feeling that fear of Walt. Or just not even fear, because he's not really kind of scared of or caring about anything at this point. Shut up. But I feel like it stays on the master for an almost unnecessary amount of time. And it keeps Saul in the action. Not because necessarily there's any reason for it, apart from the fact that you're keeping in mind that maybe Walt or Jesse is going to do something that requires you to see Saul's reaction. So either that be a punch or a shot or something. And that was in the back of my mind, because, you know, it's so incredibly tense.
I have to say, there is a part of me that's like, well,
particularly with the tarantula as well, just like the fear of death in that scene was a big, like more than I've ever felt it with Jesse and Walt.
I should mention also that, like, when he goes to hug him, he does this step forward, which is so similar to his step forward as Heisenberg, and it was like, it literally felt like this, watching the same shot as, like, when he walks out of the car and Full Measures, or when he's, you know, talks to Declan in Say My Name. It has this sense of he's Heisenberg, and then when he steps forward to, you know, give a badass monologue, or to kill Jesse, or to whatever, or say something, he hugs him, and it's so creepy.
And the thing is, it's almost like Jesse's kind of... It's exactly what Jesse's asked him to do, in a way, which kind of just...
But it's just, well, it's in the wrong...
The thing is, like, that's what makes it so interesting, is that it's kind of somewhere between, like there's reasons that it could be Heisenberg, but there's reasons it could be Walt. He's working his magic as usual, so then if he's saying, like, please just don't be an asshole, just respect me and say you need a favor or something, just treat me like a human being, then he does. That could be Walt or Heisenberg. Yeah, I suppose, like, that's the thing.
Yeah, they're pretty weird people. Yeah. Anyway...
But also, just...
I would just like to point out that the mover from like, and it goes without saying, but it's just something that you kind of overlook when you go into this detail, is that the mover from Crawl Space is back, Chekhov's mover. Like, they are laying on the Chekhov gum.
Which one? Which scene?
Well, he's brought up here, and he's a key plot point in the end. The mover, like the vacuum cleaner.
Oh,
like,
right,
as in
yeah,
the person,
yeah,
the disappearer, whatever you want to call him. This is a plot point that was teased earlier.
Yeah.
And again, it's brought up.
Yeah. Also, just potential foreshadowing when Saul says you should get one of these detects radio signals, maybe. Like that, I can see that when Walt's looking around the car for a tracker.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Because
it just
seems like an odd detail to kind of just throw in there.
Fair enough.
Particularly for,
fair enough. I can,
for V. Gilligan.
I think that could be a thing. It could also be just like you know, are we going to have Walt checking his car every single episode? Well, let's just give him a gadget.
Yeah.
Vince Gilligan, I'm here all night, folks.
Brilliant.
Yeah, but anyway, I know what you mean. Like, I think there's something. Okay, so let's get to the end, because
just wait. Walt's I just like to make a point. When Walt comes into Skylar, says, "I have chemo in 45." He's in complete darkness. Skylar turns around to him in complete chiaroscuro. Then Walt in complete darkness again. This show has made, particularly in season 4, has made such a massive focus of chiaroscuro, particularly in showing some kind of moral conflict. Walt is completely in dark. There's no light on him now.
Hey,
Skylar's still light and dark.
Why don't you explain chiaroscuro to...
Okay, chiaroscuro, light and dark on a face. As showing
partially illuminated.
Light as virtue and dark as, you know, what, evil. Fuck, I don't know. Whatever. Bad. Good and bad. So, you know, binary, like, light and dark. And Walt's completely in dark.
Yeah.
So yeah,
yeah, and as you said, it's a strangely intense way to shoot, and not
particularly considering the way it sits in relation to everything.
I like it.
I
don't know why though.
Oh, I think you know, you can just look at it like that, but like, why choose that moment in particular to?
Yeah,
you know,
that's what I mean. I'm just like, it works. Why? Oh, fuck it. It's
just all Slovis.
Yeah, sometimes you're just like, yes, it looked good.
Good on you, Slovis.
All right, so Saul's office, Jesse. First of all, Chekhov's joint.
First of all?
Yeah, I don't even know where to begin here.
Yeah.
I'm going to begin with a minor detail. And I think Blood Money, it could have been buried. Might have even been way earlier in the series. I don't know, I just remember one of the episodes we watched recently. Saul pulled out his drawer and he had a billion cell phones, and one of them was a Hello Kitty phone. I was like, ha, there's a Hello Kitty phone. Don't know if I mentioned it on the podcast, but I definitely mentioned it to you in passing.
Yeah.
I've seen it mentioned like once or twice in comments on the internet. And it's like the most, and in a show that just loves its Chekhov's guns in the very general sense, this was a very specific, like very traditional, precise use of that term, which is thrown around a lot. It's like, if you introduce a funny, distinct prop in your drama, you have to use it. It's like, so if you put a Hello Kitty phone randomly in Saul's office, you have to use it. It's so good. It's so Breaking Bad. Really. But the other Chekhov's gun, the joint.
Well, yeah, no, but just quickly, I kind of wanted it to be a Chekhov's gun, or not even a Chekhov's gun, a callback, when he's saying, "Where do you want to go?" And Jesse says, "Alaska." I was really, really hoping he would say New Zealand.
Yeah, because of Jane. The thing is, though, that...
That would be too connected.
To fan wank that one away. But yeah, I kind of agree with you, it would be a nice touch, but also I think after what happened with Jane, he probably doesn't want to remind himself of her.
Yeah,
but I know.
But
I do like... His sudden, brief fascination with Alaska is so adorable.
It's
so depressing, because you're kind of like, there may be hope for you yet, if only your entire existence isn't destroyed by the one lie that is
has been popping up, your relationship with a sociopath. If only.
Psychopath.
Psychopath, yes. Both of those terms are discredited by every psychiatric association, you're technically not allowed to use them.
Yeah, okay, so also, just one on this as well. There's no Kubi this episode, and I think it's worth noting as well that when we had the Chekhov's joint in
Can I just gloat a bit here?
What?
Well, I called this all.
You called?
Well, I didn't call it all, but you did. If you remember in the first podcast, I was like, okay, so Jesse's sparking off in the office and Hall's giving him shit about...
Huel.
I was thinking Saul and Huel.
Just Huel. No,
right, first of all, Huel has just been like basically an in-joke within the show, but he's popped up in every episode this season. Granted, this is only the third episode, but still, two episodes with like a quite notable scene with Huel in a row is distinct. And they're clearly getting you to remember this character, and in the first episode, they remind you of the last time... They remind the viewer very subtly of Huel and Jesse and their history, particularly with this one.
The rice and cigarette.
And with the rice and cigarette. And also that, you know, Huel, and also the fact that in Jesse's current state, he's smoking a lot of marijuana and he doesn't care where he does it. So they really laid, and I obviously didn't pick up on the marijuana thing, but when I saw that scene and I saw the scene in Buried, I was like, they are clearly setting up a reveal to Brock and it will come through Huel. And Huel's hilarious and we love him, but there's also a very important reason why we're seeing so much of him. And yeah, I picked it. I just knew that we would.
Yeah.
And when that scene happened, when Huel and when you were going out, and I knew that there was a big holy shit moment at the end. I said to you, I got it. I know exactly what's gonna happen. There wasn't any doubt in my mind. So you're just like, yeah, you know what's going on.
Yeah. And I mean, I like because you'd kind of like. I think I definitely wouldn't notice it anyway, but. When I saw that the first time today, I was actually just laughing my head off from the moment that Jesse passed Huel and Huel grabbed the... I knew exactly... No.
I didn't actually see it.
You didn't, see Huel grabbing the...
No,
the
like you
doobie
said...
out of his...
You, when you were like, did you see it? I'm like, oh, right, he's grabbing the marijuana. Like, I knew where that scene was headed. I was like, oh, well, obviously, he's going to drive with Huel and that's going to reveal itself. I didn't know exactly how they'd do it. I knew it would take the marijuana. I didn't see Huel actually grab it until you pointed out, see that Pat, that was him grabbing the marijuana. Then we watched it the second time.
It's
so,
so
obvious if you know
so...
it's there.
I saw it the first time. I was like, yeah, because I knew it was coming.
I knew it was coming as well. I didn't know that was the precise way they were going to do it, but yeah, he snatches it, and it's also, like, it's another great one, like, it's just noticeable enough to the audience that's still a believable pickpocket, like,
and,
Jesse wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, and see, okay, going from that to when Jesse is in front of whatever the hell that kind of modern architecture installation fucking thing is. Well,
yeah,
it's just like
I have no idea what...
It's just, well, whatever
oh, no,
it
it's
is.
It's on a freeway,
the way,
it, though?
Yeah, it's somewhere in Albuquerque. Whatever way it is, the way the sun shines on it, it kind of gets these really nice lines and just this, just geometric, just the whole image. It's just very nice and it's just...
The mise-en-scene
makes it
quite
brilliant,
good.
Brilliant, makes for brilliant composition.
This is your
everything.
Way basically of saying it looked cool.
It looked nice and it was Slovis having a good old time with his camera.
It's like the moody lighting in that scene with Walton Skylar.
Let's get everything dissecting the rule of thirds, pointing at our little man Jesse. It's just nice. It's good.
Anyway, and then of course you get that realization.
And then you get the camera circling him as we had with Hank and
course.
Marie.
And it's also interesting that, like, I think what's distinct about this episode and the way it's shot is that whole thing, and there's another example of it later that I'll talk about. The whole thing with the camera circling, it lasts very quickly. It just kind of hits circles, then we're going. So I just feel like, in general, this episode felt like it must have taken longer. I mean, it probably didn't, and I'd be interested to hear the Insider podcast on this, because it feels like there's so many of those, you know, very... you know, gimmicky, and I mean that in a good way, Breaking Bad shots, but they just use so sparingly, like, they happen very briefly, and then it immediately cuts. Mm. It's like he's setting up all these great shots and, like, so much coverage, and then just blasting through it all with this really vicious editing. And that, and the music, just Dave Porter just loses... I mean, just basically, like...
Firing on all cylinders.
The editing, like... everyone's collectively losing their shit. This is such a big moment. So, you know, Michael Slovis has basically just grabbed the camera and just is swinging it around like it's his dick at the Christmas party.
I don't know what Christmas parties are. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, anyway. Well,
but,
why
you know,
could
you
the
see the thing? Yeah, no, absolutely, I agree with you. But I think the thing
And the music is the loudest and most techno, yeah. and the editing is faster than it's ever been.
Yeah, the thing about this is, though, that makes me very interested is that I knew this moment of Jesse putting the two and two together, essentially, in this way. I knew that was coming. And, like, the thing is, so much of Breaking Bad's tension is that very Hitchcockian kind of thing of knowing exactly what's going to happen and then watching it get there in a way. Or almost,
yeah,
the way that he explains it is the bomb under the table, so, you know.
Well, there's a really great example of that afterwards with Walt at the car wash.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And that's the thing that I'm talking about, is that I knew exactly what was going to happen as soon as Jesse started smoking the joint, then saw Huell take the doobie out of his pocket and then knew that he'd put the two and two together with the rice and cigarette and therefore with Brock and Walt. I knew that was kind of coming the whole time, but seeing it happen was just as tense, and also realizing almost that everything that this implied after, the time taken there. Because, like, as rapid as it is, like, it's not a short moment. It's quite a long moment that Jesse's figuring that out. It's almost not even about giving the audience time to figure it out. It's about making them kind of nervous and anticipate the aftermath in
yeah
a way.
It's like, I'm oh just shit, it's all about to go down. And I just love
like, you know, there's no way he's getting in that car or getting the crap from
and
the
I,
dude
and
so
I love
just, like,
the way they show that, in that it's like Jesse sees the car and then he decides to go, and then it's very wide coverage. Like, you see the car come in, just pull up ever so briefly, and then drive off again, like, oh, there's the guy. Oh, I guess not, he's had a change of heart, kind of like, happens all the time.
Yeah.
I'll be on my way. Like, Chekhov's move arrives into the sunset, perhaps to be mute, and he will be used again.
Oh yeah.
Like, obviously.
Yeah.
So maybe it'll be like some really high profile guest actor. Christopher Walken as the mover.
God. I think we probably would have heard about it. But also just on this moment, this is such a Breaking Bad cliffhanger. When you think about the kinds of cliffhangers that Breaking Bad leaves us on.
Oh, the act break here.
I thought this was it.
I
thought that was the episode. And then it kept going. I was just like, no way.
But the way they this is so fucking unbearable, because it's very Breaking Bad.
You're just like, you almost never do you say, no, end, no, no,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, they cut back and you're like, oh my God, there's still more to come. Yeah, so after Jesse's found out, it just feels like the perfect place to end the episode, and then there's more. And of course, it's, you know, very Breaking Bad to have this moment of, oh, shit, and then cut to a very sort of false sense of normalcy and serenity. But they just do it to a sadistic level here. In the way they play out that car wash. You get Skylar in there, just a scene like she's giving too much change and serving a customer. Then you get Walt, and he runs up to the door, and then he stops.
So it's
opens
himself,
it collectively.
Yeah. Also very economically covered. Like, that's all kind of covered in one shot, which I love of Slovis. Thank you, buddy.
Well, in that he is, and then it's the most fucking extravagant, indulgent, in a good way.
No, but, like, there's not a whole lot of shots. There's, like, maybe four or five, like, maybe four or five in the whole sequence.
In this sequence. Oh, yeah.
So you've got the master, then you've got one back on Sky, then one on Walt, and then you've got, so that's three, then you've got two up at the soda machine.
Yeah.
You've got one with Walt going down, then one behind him. Okay, maybe six or seven, but there's a couple...
I know what you're saying. I'm just saying that, it's economic, that's the thing. Slovis, when he's doing, he will, like, lead up with these very, very economic scenes, and then just go nuts for certain scenes. Oh, but I'm just saying, like, I find, you can't say what you love about Slovis is he's an economic director.
I can. I like it when people don't flash their dick around in my face coverage-wise. I like being able to look at an image.
No, but mate, sorry. He's the main sequence in this episode. We were just talking about the absurd amount of coverage and, like, I literally said he was waving your dick around.
Regardless, there's at least continuity. So many people go, fuck continuity. Like, Michelle Monaghan at times, but anyway.
No, I'm sorry, I just have to call you on this, because you're saying, like, you can't say what you love about Michael Slovis is the one thing that he is so not doing in this episode. We've spent this entire episode talking about how many fucking shots he's using in this episode. He's
in terms of how many, so many people kind of like go mids and wides and fucking, or like four shots on one actor. No, in terms of frames, different frames you can have on one actor, particularly Hank and Marie, there's not all that many, particularly in that scene you're talking about.
I think, go back and watch it, man. There are tons.
Oh, fuck off.
There are so many.
Okay, fine, whatever. But, fine.
What, anyway, just, look, fine. But, no. But yes, in this scene, look, the thing is that, what I will say about that is that, in terms of him doing these more economic pieces of filmmaking where he's not using that much coverage, and then when he switches to his more flat, and it is flashy, it's good, but it's flashy. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. It's good because it gives the episode a rhythm and it emphasizes different bits.
Yeah.
So. We both like Michael. It's all right. Anyway,
I'm just saying that most of the time they know, like, so many people when they're on a set, they'll just go, "Oh, let's get this, let's get that." Oh, you're just in a panic, just say, "Let's get whatever." He's a cinematographer who knows exactly what he needs. He's not like a scared director who doesn't know what shots he needs to make it work in the edit. Cinematographers, more often than not, are the ones who know exactly what they need.
I know,
and he gets it.
Yeah, all right.
And he doesn't get anything more than he needs.
Yes.
And that's what I appreciate, and that's what I respect.
He gets a lot.
He gets a lot with what he gets, but he doesn't know how to do it.
He got a lot, but yes, he wasn't like, "Let's do as much coverage as we can and assemble it in the editing bay." I get exactly what you mean there. Yeah. It's not...
He's not a let's find it in the edit kind of guy, and I appreciate
that's
that.
That's true, but it's still an edit-heavy...
Yeah,
High shot count. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Maybe
cool.
we took a little while getting where we were getting where I was going.
I get where you're going. But basically, what you're saying is he's good.
Yes.
all right. Anyway, we just
mentioned that Andy's just started watching it out there. One
of our housemates is starting to watch it, so that should be interesting. I think if it emanates into the microphone.
I'd love to just kind of,
it's
like,
fine. I mean, it's just like, it's not going to ruin the mood. We'll just be hearing Breaking Bad. Anyway, so.
Also,
stop. We just skip past the entire Jesse Saul confrontation.
No, we didn't.
Yes, we did.
Oh, wait, yeah, we did.
So, all right.
Okay, yeah.
Because we have to do this quickly because we are really going over time. All right, so the camera and the music are just freaking out. Three things I want to say. So first of all, when Jesse's saying, you poison him, he's like, he's not saying that. You took it. Of course I took the joint. And then the music really ramps up and it cuts out when Jesse says, no!
Yeah.
It was the rice and cigarette.
Yeah.
And then, Saul is giving his confession. So there's another confession for the Cavaliers Break Bad confession counter. The CCC.
CBB?
Well, yeah, Cavaliers Confession Counselor, CCC.
Yeah.
And then the way he says, "You and Mr. White." I just remember he said it very amazingly, but he has just this utter disgust for Walt, but he still refers to him as Mr. White. I thought that was beautiful. I was like, this is exactly how Jesse should be reacting. We've been waiting for this moment for two fucking years now, and finally we get it, and it's exactly what you hoped it is and more.
Yep. And also, I know you mentioned, you said, like, when it cuts out, the music cuts out when he mentions the rice and cigarette. I've watched so many films and so many TV shows, and just so many things, and always been hyper-conscious of everything like that, as is evidenced by everything, the fact that we've been talking about this
for now. We're us.
Yeah. I noticed that, but didn't notice that.
That's... You didn't notice the cut in the music?
No, I did, but it wasn't like, it was like, yep.
Yeah, you were just
I don't care. I was too absorbed. Yeah, that's nice.
It's almost like being a normal person
No. For me, somehow, if I'm still immersed, despite my kind of hypersensitivity to all these kind of technical aspects, I just smile a bit. That's great.
Yeah.
And even the third time still watching it was just like, yep,
yeah, too immersive. But it is possibly the most immersive.
And also, particularly because, like, Jesse, in his, like, extreme catatonia that we've seen so far this season, kind of seeing him like that finally, there's no way that you're really going to be thinking about anything other than just the obscene energy that is now bursting out of him and will probably continue to burst out of him.
Slovis goes nuts in the editing and camera work. and the music, and Dave Porter has a freak out just because it's like, Jesse's freaking out, everyone involved in making this, do everything you wanted to do, do it, lots of it, do it quickly. Anyway, so back to the car wash. At the car wash.
Walt waffling.
Oh my God, the whole thing about his, you know.
Latching. It's catching. you're just like, finally, you're just like, you are out of your depth, buddy.
Which sounds like something like, you know, someone who, like, sounds like the start of an awful rap. Latch isn't latching, it's catching.
Now, yes, that would be an awful rap.
Like the kind of rap that Walt would come up with. Like, it just...
Oh my God.
Or like a Dr. Seuss book.
You didn't have to say that. It's... No, I'm just gonna... That's where my mind's gonna be.
Walt rapping. Yeah, Walt rapping. Walt's waffle rapping. It's just so fucking torturous because you know that a massive bomb is about to drop on the entire, and you think that
it's like, why are you, dude, like 30 seconds could be the difference for you here. I know, like, why are you still bothering to lie to Skylar?
This is what I'm saying. He loves the lie. He has to do the lie. He has to sell the lie. And also the fact is at this stage he could just say, Skylar, I gotta go. Some shit's going down. He could say that and it wouldn't make a difference. And she knows he's lying. That's the thing. It's this weird thing they've gotten to the stage with in their relationship where he lies, he performs for her, and she's just kind of like...
I don't care. No, she's not even...
But the thing is, she accepts the lies because it's like, well, it's like, Skylar, you know that's bullshit. Why do you say it? But I know it makes him feel happy. Like, it's this just bizarre thing where he has to lie all the time. Not just practically, but he loves doing the performance. And so, and it takes so long as you see serving customers and him kind of just idly standing next to the counter, then slowly getting the gun very subtly but also very obviously, and then leaving. You're going, where is this going? And of course, like, the way it was shot, when you just see the cars outside through the window, like, you think, Jesse's just going to come screaming in, isn't he?
Yeah, no,
but
that was my
then something else happens.
And that's the thing, that's what's so interesting, as I was kind of saying earlier about showing one half of a phone conversation that leaves that tense.
Yeah.
Is that you don't immediately know, oh, well, he's talking to Walt, Walt's going to this car wash, or he's talking to Jesse, Jesse's going to the car wash. So when you kind of realise that Walt's leaving and there's going to be no altercation at the car wash, your immediate thought is, okay, well, where's the what's going to happen? And then you just see Jesse at the White House.
Yeah, and I mean, the closest comparison I can think of this is the end of Half Measures, when Jesse is in that situation. You know Walt's going to do something, you don't know what, and then he just... drives his way into the frame. You kind of expect something similar here, but... All right, so it's brilliant. It's the way they've pulled this off is brilliant, because you
And particularly just the crescendo of the whole thing. It all works as one sequence.
I think, like, you know, the two questions you're asking yourself as a viewer, well, like, one of the many, but, like, one of the two that is just burning at my mind so much is, what does Jesse do when he finds out about Brock? The other one is, how does the house burn down? And the fact that they're combined is so insane. The fact that we're burning the house down in episode 3 is just even more crazy. If we hadn't seen that cold open at the start of the season, the flash forward, then the fire would have had a bit of impact. It would have been like, oh my God, he's going to burn it. Wow, that's crazy. But of course, it would have been a tad strange, a bit of a non sequitur. But the fact that we know where this goes, and instead of, like, him getting the gasoline and going, no, he's not going to, you just go, oh my God, it's Jesse. Jesse burns it down.
Yeah.
And
just the way that entire, like, I was with Sarah watching this. First when I was by myself watching this, as I think everyone was, I was actually just screaming. And as I was with Sarah, just watching him rock forward, just rock back and forth.
Yeah,
just
kind of I was on the floor, like, hot, hugging a pillow, rocking back and forth. That was during the car wash scene, because that was just... And also just, like, the most inappropriate use of comedy. And it was just so Vince Gilligan, like, we're going to draw this out and you motherfuckers are going to squirm.
Yeah.
Just one thing I also want to add about when he's walking to the house. So another example of how Michael Slovis sets up these shots that most directors would want to show off. And he just quickly flashes them and then gets rid of them. Like, he does the camera perspective on the gasoline.
Yeah.
So, first of all, because you can't have an episode of Breaking Bad without a POV shot of an object. Although it's not actually a POV shot, but it's like,
shot locked
yeah,
onto...
Yeah, what have they done? Yeah, they must have put, attached a rig to one of the barrels, so you're getting this shaky shot from that kind of looks up on Jesse, so it, like, yeah. simulates her carrying. He cuts to that for about a second, and then it's gone, and I'm just like, that... All right, that... You know, on paper, that sounds like, what are you doing wasting such a good shot, and a shot that has become associated with your series, but of course, in terms of the rhythm of where they are right now and what you want to establish with Jesse, it's perfect. And it's just the speed at which they're blazing through the whole thing is insane.
Yep, and the speed with which the fire shall rip through the house.
Yeah, so I have no idea how they're going to start.
Just this, I mean, also, there's a really scary thought that happens, and I think it must be inevitable, because yeah, I saw it happen to you the second time we watched it. It happened for me about 10 minutes after I watched it the first time, and I just went, ah! I just went, ah! Because I thought, where are Walter Jr. and Holly?
Well, all right. Look, I just want to say, there's no fucking way Holly's at home. Unless Walter Jr.'s looking after Holly, but yeah. I feel like if they kill both the kids in... Oh, they could do that.
They could, but this is the thing. It's just, it's kind of an immediate thought that you have, and you're just like, oh my god, wait, no.
But it, no, but we can't rule it out.
But it's uneasy. I don't think so.
I don't think so either, but I can't rule it out. Yeah.
And this is the thing.
Just ask yourself, like, who's in the house. Yeah, that's
but,
worth
it. Yeah, and it's just like, ooh. But the thing is, I think it's interesting, kind of considering it, because, you know, like, the counter-argument to that might be, oh, well, if they were in there, then they would have shown you them before they cut to executive producer Vince Gilligan. I don't think so. That would be worse.
Well, no, that's something you reveal in the next episode. And, I mean, I have no idea how they're going to start next week. I'd love
to see the White House on fire. That would be awesome.
Oh, yeah, I have no idea. It could be another flash forward. I mean, we kind of thought, like, they're really escalating at this time the last 2 weeks. And then you see this thing, like, oh, God, they've been holding back. Blood money. We were all going on about blood money. And you're like, that was the holding back.
Yeah. This is the
end is really beginning now.
Basically, from Jesse in Saul's office to the end, it's about 10 minutes, and it's incredible crescendo. It makes Crawl Space look like child's play.
Yeah, all exactly.
And that is saying something.
Yeah, once again, involves the mover. Interestingly enough. Anyway, we really better wrap this up because
it's getting
very late, and we've been going on for a while.
Yeah.
Just this episode and thinking about this episode gives me a lot of energy though.
I'm gonna go outside and watch it the fourth time with Andy.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, just so quickly, because first of all, we also like think this is at the moment. It's kind of, you don't want to say this after you've just watched it, so I'll hold off for now. But this is a contender for the best episode of Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
Of all time.
Yep.
But look, I don't like doing that immediately. What I will say is it's definitely the one that had the most visceral effect on me. And that's clearly what it's intended to do. So Breaking Bad's very famous for that. And usually those episodes, like your 1 minute, your half measures, your crawl space.
Face-off.
No, not Face-Off. Well, I guess we'll talk about this in Season 4, but that's actually a different kettle of fish, and that's why it's my favourite episode of that season. Right. But, yeah, like, usually those aren't my favourite episodes, but this one, because it had such a strong beginning and middle and then build up to a crescendo, and the crescendo itself was just more effective than any they've ever done. All right, so funniest moment.
I'm kind of... I don't think it was Trent. I don't think it was the one who guocks.
The one who guocks.
I'll probably go with Walt. Walt talking about the latch that isn't latching.
It is funny.
You're
but
just laughing at a number of things there. You're laughing at Walt. You're laughing at, like, where it kind of sits in the show. You're laughing at the derisive nature of this fucking writing staff's writing. You know, you're laughing at a number of things. Just like, you know, you're just kind of in this delirious state by that point.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'll go with that.
You laugh at the audacity of it, I guess. I'm going to go with the one who guocks.
The one who guocks.
I'm going to go with the one who guocks. I thought it was pretty funny. But it wasn't a particularly funny episode, so that only means so much. Favorite moment?
I reckon I'll go with... I don't know why, but I can't really think about... Well, no, I was going to say the opening frame on the cigarette, just for what it kind of means for the rest of it. But no, that was just something that popped into my head then. I really like that from just, like, what it means in the context of Breaking Bad, everything. It just really works. But I suppose I will go with, I think, Huel nicking it, because I just actually, the moment I saw Huel take the weed out of Jesse's pocket, that was more confirmation than actually seeing it happen for me. I knew, it's kind of nice knowing a show so well that when you see a moment like that, you know exactly how it's going to play out.
Yeah, and like, I knew, way before that happened, it was just like, Jesse, you take, Huel take Jesse, and went, okay,
yeah.
I know how this is going to go down. So it wasn't, that wasn't the moment that tipped me off. But also because I knew that was how it was going to play out, just because it was
awesome. I kind of know. I was. It was one of those things where I was like 80%, 90%, but then I saw that it was 100%, and then because I knew that, it was just that much more.
Yeah, it was just this kind of fatalistic. And because they do, they keep pushing back, you know, you see it, and that's very hard to catch, and you could forget it, because, like, you know, really, if, like, people were invested in Breaking Bad, they were just most shows, it would be easy to forget all the stuff with the ricin. And so, you know, there's the tip-off for the hardcore viewer, the tip-off for the regular viewer, then the tip-off for the kind of casual viewer when they just explain it with Saul. So I like that, yeah. The different layers. But my favourite moment, I love the whole confession sequence, but I just don't think anything has matched my, oh my God, as the moment Jesse pops the trunk. And we get the gasoline.
Yeah.
And you just go, is he going to shoot Walt? Is he going to do... Oh, my God, it's him. It was him. Because, like, that is such an extreme reaction. But because you know where it all ends, just, like, to see the first pieces of the puzzle connect. And this is really the first kind of direct thing that we see in that flash forward, the first move towards that, other than a general sense of bad shit happening.
Yeah. Ep 3. Well, and 11. Ep 3. 11. 11.
11, yeah. I guess it does make, like, it really in a 16-episode context that you do this now does kind of make quite a bit of sense. But we should go. It's very late. I think we've done our best, but sorry if it's a bit all over the place. However, you get it early, I guess. Anyway, email us at cavaliersdocinema@gmail.com. We actually got emails, and it was very nice. Thank you.
Yeah, it was odd and cool. Thanks,
y'all. Yeah, no, it was really nice. And, like, yeah, if email us to point out shit we got wrong, because that's good.
Yeah, we'd love to get better at being retarded.
Yes. Sorry, I said Alisa just then. It's Alina.
Alina.
Very sorry about that.
If you're still listening.
Yeah. Yes, and also Chris, who just wrote a very nice email. I'll bring it up if you're listening, Chris. Sent a link to Anna Gunn's recent article about playing Scarlett and the whole controversy, and I think that's really interesting, and you should all read it. Yeah. We don't want to talk about it. We're sick of it. If you actually think that Skylar is more morally culpable than Walt, or that sleeping with Ted Beneke is somehow on par or worse than Walt's done, you're a nut job. Like, no, we can talk about whether she's a good or bad character, but ultimately I'm just sick of the Skylar debate. Don't want to engage in it. It's also a bad time, too. The time, too, was last season where they went in depth. This season, she is actually kind of culpable. I'm done with that debate. We don't want to address it.
Mm-hmm.
Until we probably will.
Until we
do. Yeah, I don't know. It's just like we feel like if you... Everyone's talking about it, and we kind of are sick of it. So, yeah, email us at cavaliersdocinema@gmail.com. Visit us at cavaliersdocinema.blogspot.com or Cavaliers. If you can find the massive error on our television blog, then you win a mention in the podcast.
Well, I just said it.
No. But where? cavaliersdotelevision.blogspot.com. Yeah, and...
It's 2:30.
Yeah, I know.
I've got uni tomorrow.
Yeah, stop... Stop removing the facade of professionalism. And if you'd like to rate us and review us on iTunes, that would be lovely. Yes, and that was another thing. Alina gave us a really cool review.
That was nice.
Yeah, that was really good. And it gets us lessons, and they've been really good. And so, yes, and most importantly, just thanks for listening, because we've had numbers that we don't know how to deal with.
It's nice. It's odd.
I know. You're just kind of... unprecedented. You're getting steady triple digits each day. It's really nice. Whack. Yeah. So anyway, thanks so much. see you later. And
I'm Crippy.
I'm sorry. Before we go, also, I'm not putting any music at the end, partly because I want to get this out quickly, partly because it's so intense. So go with the second one because it sounds better. But anyway,
have a good one.